Hi, everybody. This is Dan Sullivan and with the Strategic Coach, and I'm with Kelly Knight and Mark O'Donnell with EOS, a global giant monster coaching company. We are just a little boutique company, but they're a monster company. I just created a thinking tool, and the title of the tool is From Failure to Breakthrough. Basically, entrepreneurs all have a lot of failures. And they have a lot of breakthroughs in their life, but they don't actually put the two concepts together. And what the thinking tool does over a matter of about a half hour, 40 minutes, is it actually shows people that if they fear failure and they don't want any more failure in their life, they're also making a decision not to have any more breakthroughs. Now, I know you at EOS, it's all been success. I know that you haven't had really... So what do you think right off the top about the concept?
Well, all great growth does come through failure and the hard times, the difficult challenges that we face. Mark, you and I have had many, many of those in the 6 years we've worked together as visionary integrators. So we have lots of examples of that, but I love the idea that you're connecting that to the breakthroughs that follow behind it. And Mark, I think we've seen that quite a bit, I'd say.
We definitely have. When I think about failure generally, I just think that there's feedback that comes out of failure. Really, if you kind of frame it as there is no such thing as failure, only feedback, and it's neither positive or negative. It just might not get what you want.
Was there a point where the two were disconnected in your life as an entrepreneur? Because they're both emotional. They're both very emotional. Failure is a very, I mean, all your new nerve endings, if it's a significant failure, all your nerve endings. And is the learning greater from the failure than it is from the breakthrough?
Yeah, totally. Because then once the breakthrough happens, at least for me, it's boring now. I'm not really in like, okay, that's nice. I'm just going to stop doing this because it worked.
And pass it off to the team. So once the breakthrough has been created, it's been launched, that's then when we hand it off to you as, you know, self-managing company, that and then that's when we move on, Mark, because we're excited by somewhat of the thrill of failure, because it's a little bit exciting. We enjoy that process of experimentation. The bigger that we've gotten, Dan, and we're not a giant, but we're growing really fast, and that's where it's in that experience of the learning and the failing and the experimentation and being entrepreneurial, regardless of our size, that is pretty energizing.
Yeah, I remember when we first started the podcast series back in the mists of time, and you had just gone through your software experience. That was a really interesting one because it wasn't over in just a week.
No. It was not. It was really all in about 3 years of our life to a large degree. And the pain of distraction, you know, that's the focus component that is so important to, I think, success is being focused, being able to say yes to a lot of things, but saying no to the most critical things that keep us on the right path. And so that was not working within our genius. That was not what we call our unique ability, using your term. It was not within what we're naturally, Mark and I, as entrepreneurs and as leaders, what we're hardwired to do better than anybody else on the face of the planet. So we really had to go back to what is the thing that we do better as an organization, better than anyone else, and where can we really deliver on that? So it was eradicating that from our business and ultimately selling it essentially to go back to those basics. And that the learning in that, the failure was that when you're not working in your genius and what you're encoded to do, God-given encoded to do, it's pretty rough. It feels pretty awful. It was not easy, lucrative, and fun. That was not ELF at the time. And we weren't getting the results that we wanted. That was the bottom line. So we really had to reinvent ourselves. So Mark, the breakthrough then became what?
Well, really just doubling down on the things that are proven, that work, harnessing all of that energy into laser focus on what we do. And you know, it's funny, we kind of look like accidental geniuses because we sold the software company right before the SaaS apocalypse. We sold it off and we don't do software anymore. And now AI has really made software a very tough business to be in. But really that focus was the total gift of not building software, not doing the things that were outside of our core focus, and lots of lessons learned, to your point of failure and the breakthrough that occurs from it. We just sort of learned, hey, let's just do what we do better than anyone else and just do that. And we'll advance it incrementally as we go. But we already have a huge network effect business. We already had everything that we needed. And there was ways to get software built without building it at all, which is what we did. We end up licensing it out in that asset sale process. We had one license partner when we were building software. We have over 30 now. And so we've created an entire marketplace and ecosystem of software companies. So essentially, by stopping to build software ourselves, we've created 5-6 new software companies.
Yeah, one of the things that's really interesting is to look at the next big project that you took on, where it might have been a failure, except for the learning that you got from the software experience. So do you see yourself, that not only did you recover and transform your thinking and your behavior from the software experience, but there was an awareness of getting into something new where you benefited from that thinking.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just ultimate clarity, Dan. So as you so often say, you're on the learning team or the winning team. We were, turns out, on the learning team for years in a row. It was maybe the most expensive education we've had. But it created real, again, focus and clarity in ways that make it so evident what you say yes to and what you say no to. And that is like, you know, a hot knife cutting through butter. And so that it just really accelerated our ability to be clear about who we are, what we represent, and to be able to defend it to anybody who might want to know. In other words, we have a lot of stakeholders that we serve at EOS. 30 groups, as it turns out. It's one of the most underestimated things in business that people just don't think about is how many people do you actually really serve. And so for us, we need to be able to stand for what we represent. You know, what are our core values, our culture, our decision making in ways that actually perpetuate, you know, our flywheel, that grow us faster. And I think that's that clarity of vision and clarity of execution, the combined visionary integrator perspective is what's really helped us during that period of struggle. You come out of it and you recognize, I don't want to repeat that same feeling again because I want to do something that I feel really great about. So we don't have to defend why we want what we want, do we, Dan? It's just because we believe this is the right thing to do. So that clarity, I think, paid itself forward quite a bit, Mark. So it was last June that technically we sold. So we're just coming, you know, we just crossed over that 1 year anniversary, actually, to that thinking and that capability.
Yeah, one of the things I notice is you mentioned it, Kelly. You talked about the emotional force of it, and I had an experience. I created a tool. First of all, it was called the Negativity Transformer, and then I realized that it applied to all experience. You mentioned, Mark, about when there's a breakthrough, you go normal with it very, very quickly. You know, you say, okay, well, that was really interesting. It's proof that we're geniuses. So, you know, and nobody wants to actually hear that. So you, and one of the things that this is 1998, I was in London, and I was already in the book writing period of my life, but I wasn't in the saving the thing that I was writing on my computer. So I flew to London on a Thursday, and on Friday morning, I gave a speech at a big financial services company. And I had the computer with me. I was using the computer to project onto the screen my presentation. And then I went up to the room where Babs and I were staying. I'm going to mention the name of the hotel because they didn't help us at all from our problems. So I've been advertising. I think they actually went bankrupt. But we went out to lunch and we came back and our door to our hotel room was totally demolished and they had stolen the computer. There was jewelry in the room. There was money in the room. They stole the Mac, which I think is a good Apple commercial. And Anyway, so we notified the management of the hotel, and they said, well, there's, you know, it's gone. There's nothing we can do about it. Nothing we can do about it. And a couple police, you know, the bobbies came up, and they said, you know, it's probably a gang, and somebody spotted you using that computer, and that's a very, very popular computer in Russia. So we suspect that your computer is on the way to Russia right now. So we'll, you know, we'll write up the report. And so that night we had a dinner with our clients, British clients, and we came back. We had jet lag, and Babs went to sleep, and I couldn't sleep. And I had a deadline of Friday. This was Friday of 1 week, and I had a deadline the next week where I had to have the completed book. And I was just pondering for three or four hours with myself. I said, there's no way I can reproduce the book that I lost. And I said, but if I create an entirely new book between now and next Friday, I'm really excited about that. I'm sure a lot of our listeners of the podcast are familiar with Colby, and I'm a 10 quick start. So I, Mark, you know, you kind of know what that's like.
I do. Yeah.
Yeah. So, a new project is always more exciting than the project you were doing.
Of course.
And I, fortunately, I had my tech guy with me, and he had a duplicate Mac. And so we created, I just sketched out an entirely new book. And long story short, next week we delivered a brand new book, and it was vastly better than the book that had been, you know, lost. But I was pondering the experience, and I said, you know, when something bad happens, you actually have a lot of energy, but it's negative energy. So the job is to take that negative energy and immediately focus it on a positive new project.
That's right.
Yep.
And what's really interesting about this is that in spite of having a lot of negative experiences, you've had a lot of failures, that always produced a breakthrough, we still don't want to have the failures. And so it's the openness to the negative feeling of a failure, because I think it's actually the catalyst that really focuses your mind.
Yeah, the openness to whatever is possible, regardless of what feelings you might have going through it, I think is that capability that actually allows you to not hold back. Because if we got caught up in feelings, which are sometimes not based in reality, by the way, it's just a feeling, and that's okay. We all have, we're all entitled to, and we are all entitled to our feelings, as I will often say, but it, for it,
and you're entitled to experience them by yourself.
Yes,
that is true.
we sometimes invite
people. Completely your property. It's completely your property.
That's right. Mm-hmm. But it is interesting, Mark. You and I have talked about how feelings do not equal reality.
Well, feelings aren't facts. Feelings aren't facts.
That's right. Yeah. So if we can disconnect ourselves from the possibility that our feelings are just our feelings, and go and experience what we need to experience, then I think we're less held back by the fear of what those feelings might, you know, the being afraid or intimidated or whatever the thing might be. Imposter syndrome sometimes creeps up. You know, if we could just let go of all of that stuff and just do what we think is best and the right thing, and serve kind of our personal greater good or that of our organization, it allows us to live in a more freedom-based mindset.
Yeah, my sense is, so this is year 52 for me coaching entrepreneurs. The difference between entrepreneurs and non-entrepreneurs is just that entrepreneurs have learned how to utilize failure a lot better than the general public. Successful entrepreneurs, not all entrepreneurs, but the ones who are really good. I was thinking of Elon Musk with his SpaceX, of just creating new rockets and then forcing them to fail. And his whole point is to get through the failure stage as fast as you can to the, that's probably part of his popularity as something to invest in, not afraid of failing. Yeah. He's got very modest goals for his IPO on SpaceX, $1.75 trillion.
You know? Right. Little tiny IPO. Are you one of most, it's oversubscribed and made available to the general public, at least a portion of it. I do think that's interesting, because when we look at the way the world reports on a rocket that blows up. It's completely different than the way Elon Musk and SpaceX perceived that explosion, right? The world is like, oh, another failure. He's done for. And the result of the SpaceX.
Although I think he was like, really delighted the day that Jeff Bezos' rocket exploded.
Yeah, he's like, good on you. You actually did
good
something
on you.
That was.
Yeah, I hope you learn a lot from this.
Right. Just flushed $1 billion down the drain. Good for you. Little healthy competition. But you mentioned Colby, Dan, and also really thinking about my entrepreneurial journey. And since I was a little kid being the tinkerer, and I think initiating quick starts generally do the thing, and then they learn after it's over, and they don't really contemplate doing the thing before you do the thing.
Yeah.
Right. Like you just go do that and you're like, okay, well, that worked out really great, or that was really terrible. I'm going to do it differently next time. And then you just keep on reiterating on that. And I took that from my career as an engineer, just constantly experimenting. And other engineers took the approach of sitting down and doing math and things. I'm like, eh, screw that. I'm just going to go and turn some levers. I'm going to go experiment. And they would always be amazed that I got these things to work because I didn't sit at my cubicle. I just went out in the field and went and did it. And I almost killed myself a few times too. But aside from that, I mean, that was just different feedback. But I think that quick starts are going to just learn and kind of approach that failure a little bit differently than maybe the resistant quick starts might.
I had a conversation with Kathy Colby about 5 years ago, and we lost her. We lost her last year. But and I said, you know, the fact finding is really, really interesting. I said, I find as a quick start that I do just as much fact-finding as fact-finders do, except I do it after I've gone into motion. In other words, after I've made the decision to go for it, then the fact-finding really, really, you know, your fact-finding really maniacally, your fact-finding.
Right. You know. You buy the car and then you start researching if you bought the right one after you've already driven it home in the driveway.
Yeah. Yeah. Kelly, what about you?
Well, my Colby is my Colby is a little different than both of yours. I'm a 7.7.6.2, so my six is the quick start. But you know, I would say over time it's been.
We find it easier to go to sleep at night than you do, though.
Maybe so. I don't know. I won't know because I'm not a 10.
You got everything going.
I got a lot going on.
We just have one.
Well, there's definitely a lot going on up there in my head. Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah. Lots of that I'm thinking about. But, you know, when I look backwards in time, I think that I've always loved experimentation. You know, the story I say is that my dad was an entrepreneur. So I grew up with that in my household, is the openness to experimentation. So to me, it's more about pulling levers and seeing what works and what makes people smile or not. And then that informs kind of what I'm willing to try or not forward moving. This worked. Let's do more of that. This didn't work. Let's not do that. Let's avoid that. Let's try something else. So for me, there is emotion tied to it because there's a lot of I think there's a lot of fun in making things that work and work for others and help other people. So for me, I've loved that component of it. And sometimes I do something and it just makes me happy, and that's okay too. So when we think of it from an individual basis versus a company basis, I would say I apply that across personal and business too.
But, you know, the thing that really strikes me, I remember back during COVID and we had to switch entirely. And I guess you did too. Everybody had to switch to virtual. One of the conversations that was sort of constant during COVID, when we were doing our Zoom calls, the entrepreneurs would say, "When do you think we're going to get back to normal? When do you think we're going to get back to normal?" And I said, "Normal, that's a really interesting concept." and I said, you know, and I said, I understand that everybody's got their own normal that they would like to get back to. But I said, the thing that I'm really struck by, what if this is just the beginning of abnormal forever? And one of the big things is just big systems falling apart in the face of change. And I've really, really noticed, especially with the airlines and air travel, I've really noticed that they, one of the ways they dealt with COVID, the airlines, is that they early retired all their pilots and people who had been ground crew, you know, the actual, you know, getting people on the plane, getting people scheduled and everything else. And they were replaced by people, new people, who were actually doing their job by reading the job manual. They didn't have that experience, you know. I'm noticing that they're just staffed enough to handle things if everything works perfectly. But the moment That's something true. Doesn't work perfectly, we flew to Chicago on Sunday, so this day before yesterday, and we landed and we were on the runway for 2 hours. And it was a nice day. It was a nice day. It was not weather or anything. But they told us that they had just had three planes in our, where we come in with Air Canada. And Air Canada is very junior partner to United Airlines. And they said they had three planes that had mechanical breakdowns or was discovered, you know, when they were at the jetway. And they had to, they were having a hard time getting them away from the jetway. So they had a good story to tell. Anyway, and I was saying, I bet before COVID, they would have handled it a lot better. But I have a quarterly book in the future called Big Systems Falling Apart, Breaking Down, or whatever the thing is. So the big thing is, how do you make being in a state of constant, unpredictable turmoil normal? How do you do that? And my feeling is starting to appreciate failure.
Right. Well, failure is a constant, like change is a constant. So we might as well embrace it. Mm-hmm. But your observation about the airlines is interesting, Dan, because Mark and I, we've been traveling a lot this year. And I have seen, I would say at least 50% of all of my flights are canceled, delayed. So there's some kind of mechanical error, something.
Mechanical problems. The translation of mechanical problems. We don't have enough passengers for this flight.
It is a mechanical problem of sorts.
We don't have enough humans on the plane. Yeah, but I, you know, whatever is happening, you know, there, when we talk about AI, and this is something that we work on at EOS, we are using AI in combination with what I think is a platinum standard, which is someone's unique ability, which is, of course, Dan Sullivan, strategic coach term, but everyone's unique ability paired with AI.
Oh, yeah.
Is the platinum standard. But, you know, where it goes terribly wrong, we've also seen this through failure, is where you see a person in a seat on the accountability chart and they are attempting, notice the word attempting, to use AI to do something great, to do some productivity tool or strategic plan or something like that. But if they don't have the get it wanted capacity in their seat to be able to interpret what they're actually pulling in terms of an output, a prompt and an output, it goes terribly wrong.
Yeah.
It's almost comical because it becomes a pressure test for, is that individual capable of doing what's required in their seat? So the application in an EOS-run company, I think it's very interesting when you consider that that's the truth. So how does that translate to airlines, how to manufacturing, all kinds of industries? It's, I think, where AI can be a great tool and where it can go terribly wrong.
Here's another thing that relates to what you're saying about the people who are very experienced people who had 30 or 40 years of sort of improvising, actually, when there was an emergency. They had great teamwork and they knew how to, you know, they knew how to adjust to different situations, but they were let off. They were early retired. But Peter Diamandis showed me some research which indicated that there are more new people who are becoming entrepreneurs after 70 years old than ever in history. And my sense is that the people who had these great systems experience, they're very knowledgeable, they're very skillful. They know how, you know, if there's bad weather, they know how to respond to that. If, you know, if there's a 9/11, they know how to respond to that type of situation. And they're gone. They have systems knowledge. They have institutional wisdom. First of all, 1/3 of all American workers are not retiring at 65 right now. This has been going on now for about the last 4 or 5 years. And some of it's out of necessity. They just don't have enough money to handle retirement, but it's mostly they don't want retirement. They don't see any value in retirement, but they've got great skills.
And they have the pattern recognition of what great looks like, mm-hmm. what a proper result looks like, where younger folks, they don't have that systems experience. They don't know what great it looks like. And therefore, they just accept anything that AI spits out as the truth, when the reality is it's not, because they just can't tell the difference. As we're talking here, I keep thinking, too, that there's what I'm finding more and more. There's a pretty big deficit of clarity and confidence in people. They can't make a decision without going to AI or going on Amazon and reading a review before making a decision. And I'm wondering how that will play out as we move forward, when we have people who just can't take action because they lack clarity, they lack confidence in themselves and what they're capable of or not at scale. I'm not sure that we've ever seen in human history that level of uncertainty on an individual basis.
Well, I think it happened with the civilizations that disappeared.
Well, maybe that's where we all end up. I don't know.
I think that the ability to deal with unpredictable complexity, I think, is, I just wonder if things just shift, that it's the sign of a industry or a system that just isn't up to dealing with new possibilities and new demands, and it's always happened. But I think we're in that period. You've accurately described the period, that it's the inability to make a decision, and it's happening at scale because they're connected to each other in networks. So you have one person whose decision is absolutely crucial for the rest of the network to work.
And that amplifies to me the role that strategic coach plays, that EOS and EOS implementers play, because in a lot of ways, the entrepreneurs that we're having conversations with, they're looking to someone to give them the confidence, and they're really borrowing confidence from you if you're running the workshop, or one of the associate coaches, or from their EOS implementer, to say, hey, you do this all the time and you study entrepreneurs and entrepreneurship all the time. Just tell us what to do.
Yeah.
Please just tell us what to do. Yeah. And we're coach. We don't really tell people what to do. But I just think it's interesting how that is probably a good future view in the type of business that we are in, because of that lacking clarity, lacking confidence. And to Kelly's point, if you do lack clarity, you lack confidence, and you multiply that with AI, you end up with complete and utter chaos.
Ooh.
I mean, just totally opposite. And then if you do have confidence and you have clarity on what it is that you want, multiplied by AI, that is 100x, 1000x, or better result. And I think we're just seeing this sort of
division,
bifurcation,
yeah,
of the world, really, yeah, all at one time and, yeah, fast.
Yeah.
But thinking about our thinking it could be kind of dangerous. Think about it. So, Dan, what you said about unpredictable uncertainty, and for people who can't see the pattern because they don't have the real world experience, because they're borrowing it from someone else, or they're seeking AI to fill gaps because they don't have it within themselves, are then expected to create clarity in the world that we live in. It's a little like, thinking this out, it's going to become that discernment is something that we talk a lot about at EOS, is where do you get that discernment from that judges the instinct and intuition, maybe along data and other things that you're looking for, but to get the clarity in the decision-making. And mm-hmm. one of the other things, Mark, we've talked a lot about recently, it attaches a little bit to the issues book that came out earlier this year that you wrote, but mm-hmm. it's the speed of decision-making, solving issues permanently at the root. And so we're talking about sometimes big global things like the pandemic and flus and things like that, but also just in day-to-day decision-making. But if you can't discern what you've even learned mm-hmm. and what went wrong so that you can move toward your breakthrough, I just think that that whole pattern is broken. That's what just makes it all that much more important to be part of things like strategic coach, where you can slow down and actually kind of dissect your thinking a little bit more so that you become more clear in a world that's very confusing and chaotic filled. So I think that's something that we sometimes, Mark, have to remind ourselves is to slow down. Let's think about our thinking. Let's process what's actually happened and how do we use it for good.
Breathing's good too. If you breathe while you're doing that, it's actually very good.
Yeah. Continuous breathing is probably best.
Yeah. So let me ask you a question, and this is a great party question. Where has AI so far done you the most good personally?
A silly example, but my gardening. Oh. I'm an avid gardener, master gardener, and I play one on TV, but I have taken pictures of all of the things that I have in my yard, all the different, you know, little sets that I've done over the years, perennials and annuals and all of these things, and I put it into AI, and then I give it a prompt of what I want to do with it. And then it completely computes like the X number of flats of beds of flowers that I need and what I'm going to have to consider for the soil because of the sun and where I'm located in Michigan. And it's been really kind of a cool project this year as I continue every year to enhance my garden. So that's how I've used it this year. That's been something new that's the first time I've done it this year.
Yeah, I mean, from a personal perspective, we did a kitchen.
You as not personal, like your personal life.
Personal life, okay. So
no,
just like
I'm just talking about you as an individual.
Personal. Okay, got it.
And let's line it up with your greatest strength. Are you using AI to amplify your greatest strength?
Yeah, so I have done a lot of writing, as have you, Dan. And I initially was like, hey, this is the best thinking partner to go back and forth and pressure test ideas. And as a 2-2-10-3 Colby, in my writing, I typically would miss risks that are, I just didn't care about them very much. You know, so what I've been doing is writing the article, the chapter or whatever it might be, and then saying, hey, what are the risks that I've missed? What are things that other people who do not have my Colby, what are they thinking about? What are they concerned about? And so really embodying a persona of the opposite thinker that I am, and then being able to close the gaps in my writing. And, you know, kind of speaking of writing, initially the thought was, oh, this is amazing. This is pretty good. But very, very quickly, you can spot AI writing from a few miles away now, and all of that is just, you know, people are tired of seeing that kind of thing. So I'm really doubling down on just the craft of just writing it myself, but I'm using all of the thinking to address risks, gaps, they get really tuned in to who the reader is and what they care about. And so that would be my biggest advantage, I would say, using AI. Amongst building all sorts of other MCPs, and you know, I tinker all the time with it.
Yeah. Well, mine is totally writing. That's what I went after, because my role in the company is really driven with new stuff. You know, you have to get new stuff out of. And so my quarterly books, so when I was 70, which is 12 years ago, I set a goal that I would write a new small book every quarter. And this is quarter number 47, and I'm working on book number 47. So this has been great. And about loosely translated, about four of the books have now become major market books. So, you know, and it's really easy to sell a publisher on an idea of a new book if you give them a new book.
Here it is. Like a cooking show.
Yeah. You give them a little book, and it's got a beginning, a middle, and an end, and they did it. But my quarterly books used to take me about 3 weeks to get the structure of them, and then we had to hustle a little bit to get it to the printer in time. And now it takes me three hours to get the structure right. And then I'm interviewed on my transcript. I'm interviewed by Shannon Waller. I find it amazing. And I've just focused on one thing, because I'm a writer. I've been a writer for 50 years. And I've got a lot of writing experience. And I started with Perplexity, but I really like Claude. Claude's got such a nice feel to it. You don't have to make Claude more intelligent. Claude's already intelligent. But what I notice in our company, and we're not putting a great push on AI that you have to know this stuff, AI. We're just watching what they naturally go for. You know, I would totally approve of getting a better handle on your garden.
Yeah.
That's really great. And we do the 4x4. We do the 4x4 every quarter, our tool. And we're a year and a half into it now, and we're starting to see really, really great results. Anytime one human brain interacts with AI, they do something different. And I think it's making it very unpredictable from the standpoint of the stock market. And I think it's making it very, very difficult from the standpoint of the technology makers. They say, what's everybody doing? Nobody's doing the same thing. Every brain is interacting with AI very differently. So this is going to be one of those great historic periods where all hell breaks loose.
It will come to a head at some point.
We see the disparity of those that are using it and what it means for them and those that don't use it or resistant to it. That's one of the things that we've seen, is that where there's an inability or not a desire to at least try to experiment with whatever the prompt might be, whatever the project might be, just try it. It's a little bit like put your shoes on to go to the gym, just get in there and start using it and experimenting with it. And it is contagious, because we had a member of our team who was not really all that interested, thought their seat wouldn't really benefit from the use of AI. But then once he got in there, he's producing some pretty incredible things. So like anything, if there's a barrier, a mental barrier, it's getting folks to open up their mindset to getting in there and trying it. But that's where all creativity will be born. I mean, my son is he's an analyst, and he's using AI to take it throughout entire organization. So what he did in his own one seat as an analyst was observed by, you know, some kind of leaders, and they said, hey, can you put it across the whole organization? But if not for his at least experimenting and trying, he never would have gotten that opportunity. So I am hoping that every generation, to include our younger generation, are embracing it and thinking about how do I make myself the most capable that I possibly can be, even if at some point the job disappears, because an analyst job in all theory, Mark, right, a few years, he's going to have to reinvent himself again. So it is going to become an interesting period of time, what AI actually does to every industry on the face of the planet.
You know, we talk about wanting what you want. And today, as we're recording this, Claude Anthropic has released their newest model called Fable 5, which is the first Mythos broadly available model. And you prompt in a completely different way than you prompted yesterday. And what you actually do is you just simply do /goal, and you write it as what it is you want, and then you go away for a few hours. And then you come back, and it's completed, and it will run for many, many hours all by itself. You never have to think about the how anything gets done. You simply have to clearly state the goal of what it is that you want, and then have some sense of the workflow that you want to impact or the process that you want to impact as a result of that. So I just think that, you know, talking about where it is that, you know, from a writer's perspective, from an analyst perspective, from a company's overall perspective, what is it that you actually want? And the models are just going to keep getting better and better. The AI you're using today is the worst one you're ever going to use. It's just going to keep getting better. Get real clear on what you want. And then
that's my take. And just to go back to something, you have to get simpler and simpler as you go forward. So you think of the EOS model, you know, you have a very, very simple operating structure for a company and everything else. And what we strive to do in Strategic Coach is get everybody inside their unique ability. Before you multiply, you really want to simplify. And keep simplifying. You know, the multiplication will handle with the technology. You don't have to worry about the multiplication. Now the goal is to really simplify. Well, I have a great free zone workshop for you this quarter. So see you in a month. Thanks a lot. It's been great from our standpoint to see the growth journey that you are on with EOS. I can remember years and years EOS being developed every quarter in the workshop. And it's really great to see where it's going now.
Well, a huge credit to you, Dan, for the inspiration that you've given with Gino in the early days and now with Mark and myself. We're so grateful to be a part of Strategic Coach's workshops and your program, and I'm excited to use the tools as we continue to march forward, Mark.
No doubt.